Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today's show is all about music. Later in the hour, Robert Wyatt joins us to talk about the musical legacy of the Cotton Club in the 1920s and 30s. But first, we welcome back Jung Ho Park to discuss American composers known as mavericks for their groundbreaking work. Jung Ho is the artistic director and conductor of the Cape Symphony. Welcome back. Always good to see you.
It's great to be back, Mindy.
So this is the final performance of the 2017-18 season for the Cape Symphony, and you're ending the season with a performance titled American Mavericks. So what makes a composer a maverick?
Well, I think it's someone who has the courage not to take the well-beaten path. And I think of Beethoven as being a great example of that. The things that he completely destroyed, he was an iconoclast of the highest order. Igor Stravinsky, bad boy Igor Stravinsky. And I think of Leonard Bernstein, but in a very American way, that these are people who grew up with classical music, in quotes, but they wanted to find their own voice, a new way of expressing ideas and emotion. And these three people that were presenting on this concert, Leonard Bernstein, John Adams, and Philip Glass, all did that in their own way.
Mm. And you know, when you think about that, a lot of people have this image of classical music as, you know, kind of set in stone, this old school, and they don't, you know, where jazz is kind of improvisational and it's alive now. But that's one of the things that you bring about with classical. It is alive now, and these guys are kind of examples of that, aren't they?
Exactly. They were trying to find, of their own time, a way to bring in the outside world into the concert hall, those marbled concert halls. And Leonard Bernstein did that beautifully. But, you know, he's a dichotomy. And I love that because America is a dichotomy. On one hand, we grew up from we borrowed a government system, a parliamentary system, and we imported that democracy to America. And yet, we're constantly trying to find our own voice through music, particularly rock and roll, media, entertainment. And Leonard Bernstein embodied that. Yes, he went to the conservatory. Yes, he was a well-trained musician. But he looked around in vital New York in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, and he wanted to bring that music, unite that with him. I think his career hampered because of that. He was a serious maestro of the highest order, but I think orchestras and serious classical audiences didn't take him seriously. So it wasn't until actually he went to Europe and built his career. I mean, he was music director of the New York Philharmonic, but the Vienna Philharmonic, one of the great orchestras and other great orchestras in Europe, embraced him, his exuberance for life. Mm-hmm. And in the end, he became one of the most heralded conductors of his generation.
So how did you decide whose music to include in this performance?
Well, first off, I started off with birthdays, because major birthdays, Leonard Bernstein's 100th centenary, John Adams' 70th birthday, and Philip Glass's 80th birthday. So why not throw a birthday party?
Hmm. All right, so Leonard Bernstein, we're talking about him, perhaps one of the most beloved American composers. Was he a maverick right from the start of his career, or was that something that developed later?
It developed later. He was an assistant at the New York Philharmonic, and it's that story that we all dream about as conductors. The conductor got sick, and he filled in at the last minute, did a fantastic job. And so he was known primarily as a conductor for a while, but then when he started writing music, and it was a little off-putting. Here's a guy who's writing On the Town and West Side Story musicals. Oh my goodness, our maestro writing a Broadway musical. But when you listen to West Side Story, and you really take it apart, it's really not Rodgers and Hammerstein. Mm-hmm. It was completely new, more sophisticated in some ways, but more and excitingly relevant as well.
Right. So we've got a few pieces from Bernstein. What are we going to hear first, and why did you include this in the performance?
We're going to perform this at our birthday party because, for me, this selection from West Side Story does not choose the obvious pieces, but it chooses the most symphonic pieces. You won't hear, for example, Maria, you'll hear a piece like Mambo. And that's where the orchestra gets to shine in the musical. And that's what Leonard Bernstein did. He stole all the great orchestral moments and put it in this beautiful suite.
Thank you. West Side Story is an iconic musical with broad appeal. So do you think introducing a younger demographic to the music of Leonard Bernstein is one way we could expand the audience of classical music?
Absolutely. And if Lenny was here today, he would say that's why I wrote this as well. That music has to speak to today's audience. And that's why I try to bring the most exciting guest soloists, people who knock it out of the park. I try to present pieces that speak, that still have a resonant message today. So Lenny is part of that journey.
And talk a little bit about how he would relate to the younger audience, playing music that they could relate to and kind of bringing them into down that lane of classical music.
He did it so effortlessly. I mean, on one hand, he can give his famous Harvard lectures and completely engross all these doctoral students. On the other hand, during his CBS show, Young People's Concerts, he could sit down at the piano with all these young children in their Sunday best and explain why Tchaikovsky, who wears his heart on his sleeve, is just like Elvis Presley or the Beatles. Mm-hmm. He'd go, ooh, on the piano, and the kids would smile and giggle because they're, you're not supposed to laugh and have fun in a concert hall. He made it okay for that. So he just had this incredible gift to speak to both the common man as well as the intellectual.
Okay, let's hear another piece by Bernstein. What's next?
We're going to hear this introduction to a march, and this is the conflict of Bernstein that I was talking about. You're going to hear this very austere and almost hyper intellectual beginning. And this is what Bernstein could do very well. He would hear dissonance and music that seemed very thorny. And then it's going to burst forth in a rousing march, with almost a sense of a beer stein in your hand. And this is the duality of Bernstein, two parts of the coin that are just smashed against each other.
So you can certainly hear that. Now, so when Bernstein's pieces debuted, as you mentioned, they were sometimes seen outside the mainstream of classical compositions, and there were some who were critical of his style, but yet they did resonate with audiences, right?
Boy, it is such a difficult question for any classical musician or any artist. Is it, do you want to be loved or do you want to be respected? And it's for Leonard Bernstein, it was either on or off. You have a huge hit like West Side Story, and then you have his Jeremiah Symphony, which not a lot of people know in the general world. And I don't know if Bernstein ever, I know he struggled with it, but I think it's just the way it had to be for him. He had to be either hot or cold in his musical language. Yeah.
The work of John Adams will also be featured in the American Mavericks performance. He's described by some as a minimalist. Why?
Minimalism is a movement that happened in the late 70s and continues to this day, actually. And it's minimal because the tools, the cellular ideas are very singular at a given moment. it's like watching a study of red and staring at it for a long time. There's a wonderful, I don't know if it's a Zen saying, but if you don't understand something, stare at it for a minute. And if you still don't understand it, stare at it for 5 minutes. And it changes the perception of time, Mindy, in a way that watching a sunrise changes your perception of time, or listening to a Wagner opera. At first, your heartbeat beats fast and you check your time. You want to know what's for dinner. But then you calm down. And then all of a sudden, your perception of your humanity changes. And minimalism was extremely, extremely popular. And John Adams and Philip Glass before him were, and Terry Riley, part of that triumvirate, led this revolution. It seems repetitive. It seems like, you know, what am I listening to? What's happening? But once you quiet that voice inside your head, you listen, and the music itself doesn't become the miracle, but the subtle changes become the miracle.
So what are some of John Adams' better known compositions?
Wow, a lot. He wrote a beautiful work called Harmonia Lyra. He wrote an opera called The Chairman Dances. And in it, you would think you cannot sustain an entire opera with minimalist music. It's like, okay, well, how can you? Because usually opera thrives on variety,
right?
Fast and slow and action and blood and all these things. But he has a way of writing music that just transports you into another world. And that's why I chose The Chairman Dances from the opera.
Thank you. This is from whatever?
This is Nixon in China.
And then we have Philip Glass, another well-known American composer. He's written music for opera, theater, film.
Oh, yeah.
What do you find about his work that sets him apart from other contemporary composers?
Well, at a time in the 60s, when composers were writing very intellectual music, music for the universities rather than for the people, he decided to pull away from that complexity. And he was really one of the founding fathers, along with Terry Riley, of writing music that was very simple. And I think that that's a result of the 20th century. The music you just listened to feels like you're on a train, the clickety-clack, the clickety-clack. And this consistency of rhythm is one of the hallmarks of minimalism. And I think that's really a byproduct of our new civilization.
All right, so we're going to hear a piece composed by Philip Glass. What do you have for us?
It's called Anniversary Overture, which is really self-referential. He didn't write it for this concert, unfortunately. That would have been very expensive. But because we're celebrating the anniversaries of Philip Glass, John Adams, and Leonard Bernstein, I thought it would be so apropos to do this really beautiful, lovely, exciting piece.
Cape Symphony performances often feature different genres and composers, and as conductor, you and the musicians have to be on your toes when there's so much variety in a performance. So is that a challenge?
Oh, no. I thrive on it. It's... I don't know if you like dim sum or not, but the thing I love about going to dim sum is like there are 100 different choices of what you can eat, and I am an omnivore. I don't know if I have ADD, but I probably do to a certain extent because I crave variety. And so I love giving the audiences as much different kinds of music sensations as I possibly can cram into one evening.
So what do you get from the musicians of the symphony? Are they like, Jung Ho, are you kidding me? Or
at first they did. At first when I came 10 years ago, they're like, wow, this is, you know, this is crazy that, you know, all these different genres in one program. But the audiences love it, and therefore now our orchestras love it. And I have the reason I love the Cape Symphony so much is they are game. Mm-hmm. That's the word for it.
Yeah. So who are they? Are they from the Cape? Do they have day jobs outside of music? Who makes up the symphony?
For the most part, they're all professional musicians. They dedicate their entire lives to a career in music. They may supplement it with teaching, private lessons, gigging on the side, but for the most part, our musicians are fully professional. And that's a great question, because I think there was a time when the Cape Symphony was a community orchestra, but really those days have passed.
Yeah. So as you look to the next crop of classical musicians and composers coming of age, what stands out?
That, like Sally Fields, are accepting her Academy Awards, they just want to be loved or liked. And they're writing music in a much more friendlier, I would say filmic way, that it's tonal, which means that you can often sing the melody. John Williams really heralded this whole convergence between great old-fashioned romantic film writing and entering into the concert hall.
So we're going to go out with a piece by Leonard Bernstein. What did you choose for us?
Some more West Side Story. Again, we're going to be featuring this beautiful suite on our concert. And this is a song that defies a Broadway musical. It could be placed in any concert hall, but it just happens to be existing right in the center of this gorgeous musical.
American Mavericks will be performed by the Cape Symphony Saturday, May 5th and Sunday, May 6th. We'll have more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Artistic director and conductor, John Hopak, thank you again for joining us. It's always great to see you.
Thank you.
Coming up after a break, the music of Harlem's Cotton Club in the 1920s and 30s. You're listening to The Point. We shift musical gears from American classical to jazz. We welcome back Robert Wyatt, Steinway artist, Smithsonian Institution lecturer, and specialist in American music. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mindy.
I want to dance. Don't you
know?
So we are talking about the Cotton Club, which I think everybody's heard of the Cotton Club. New York City, was it 1923?
Yes.
Yeah, when it opened. You know what is interesting about this, though, is when I think of the Cotton Club, you know, you think Harlem, and you think of all of the black entertainers who, I did not realize it was an all-white establishment.
Yes. There were 500 jazz clubs in Harlem by 1925, and 10 of them were whites only. So the Cotton Club was the best, the aristocrat of Harlem.
Yeah, the aristocrat of Harlem. Amazing talents that came through
there.
We're
going to hear some music today.
All right, so let's get started. What are we going to hear first?
Well, pretend that it's 1927 and Charles Lindbergh has just flown across the Atlantic. Babe Ruth has just hit 60 home runs. And Gene Tunney beat Jack Dempsey in Soldier Field. So pretend that you're in Manhattan and you catch the Uptown Cab. You go to 142nd Street in Harlem at Lenox Avenue. And someone opens the door for your cab. And you walk to this doorway that says the Cotton Club in little neon lights. You walk up the stairs. And then you open the door and you're in the Cotton Club. It's just the most magical place. There's smoke, there's music, people are dancing, hundreds of people are having fun. And if you look up on the stage in 1927, you would see this young man in his great band. His name was Edward Kennedy Ellington. And he'd just come up from Washington with his band.
The Duke.
And he was the new king. They started, you know, broadcasting radio live from the Cotton Club. Every week, Duke Ellington made national exposure. So let's hear Duke Ellington doing the Cotton Club stomp.
Thank you.
You know, I'm just thinking of these, the people who visited in this heyday, guests like Jimmy Durante, George Gershwin, Sophie Tucker, Al Jolson, Mae West. I mean, anybody who was anybody. This was the hip spot, wasn't it?
This was it. Sunday night was celebrity night at the Cotton Club. So if you were a wealthy or influential political athlete, if you were white, you sat in the audience. A few black people, like Langston Hughes and Josephine Baker and Roland Hayes, they could sit in the audience and be members. But everybody else was white. Everybody who worked there was black.
All right. So what are we going to hear next?
Well, the Great Migration occurred at the beginning of the century because, number one, people didn't have enough work, black people. And also the boll weevil hit the cotton crops in 1915, so you couldn't pick any longer. And then there was the Ku Klux Klan. There were hundreds of thousands of Ku Klux Klan people in the country of the South. And people just didn't want to get lynched anymore, so
yeah,
they came north.
They left,
and once they got north, things changed. Now, George Gershwin wrote an opera called Porgy and Bess. And Peregrine Bess was taking place in South Carolina with a bunch of African-American people in the turn of the century. And he talks about the going to New York with Bess. This is Sporting Life, you know, the drug dealer. So he was talking about taking Bess to Harlem because it was part of the Great Migration. So here is Sammy Davis Jr. singing one of the last arias from Porgy and Bess, "There's a Boat That's Leaving Soon for New York."
There's a boat that's leaving soon for New York. Come with me, that's where we belong, sister. You and me can live that high life in New York. Come with me, there you can't go wrong, sister. I'll buy you the swellest mansion up on Upper Fifth Avenue, and through Harlem we'll go strutting. We'll go a-strutting, and there'll be nothing too good for you. I'll dress you in silks and satins, in the latest Paris styles. All the blues you'll be forgetting, there'll be no fretting, just nothing but smiles. Come along with me, that's the place. Don't be a fool, come along.
Sammy Davis Jr. Why, what a voice, huh? You know, you think of him as the kind of with the Rat Pack thing, but he could sing.
Oh, yeah.
And dance.
Yeah.
All right, so talk a little bit. The Cotton Club really produced, I mean, when you look at the names of the people who performed there and they go on to really great fame.
Yes. Well, Harlem was experiencing a social and artistic explosion in literature and poetry and dance and music and photography. Everything was all coming together, and Harlem was a place to be if you were an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the men, a poet, Langston Hughes, was one of those black men who could actually sit in the audience at the Cotton Club. He didn't like it at all, but he knew it was work for his people, and he wrote some wonderful poems about his experience in Harlem. So we're going to hear him reading "I Too Sing America." This is Langston Hughes live.
"I Too Sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow, I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody'll dare say to me, 'Eat in the kitchen,' then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful we are and be ashamed. I, too, am America."
Wow.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, why was it that Langston Hughes and some of the other more prominent Black Americans were able to sit in the audience and others were not?
Well, you know, Oney Madden and Rothstein, the sort of mobster heads of the Cotton Club, really wanted to make it a place where white people could come and see African Americans being animals. But they also were eventually forced to say, well, if you're a celebrity Black person, you should be able to come too. Mm. So a few came, and Langston Hughes was one of the ones selected because he was a real voice of the Harlem Renaissance. They called it the New Negro Movement. It wasn't the Harlem Renaissance until later. Mm. But Langston Hughes was one of those guys that could sort of almost go anywhere.
Yeah. And there was actually a movie, The Cotton Club, Francis yeah. Ford Coppola, which kind of showed this history of the club in the context of race relations.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting because in 1925 or so, a filming crew came in and did some of the floor shows in the Cotton Club. And they put those in, you know, Coppola's movie. Mm-hmm. And so it was a silent movie, so there's no sound, but you could really see what it was like being in the Cotton Club in the 20s, the roaring 20s, F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Jazz Age.
Yeah. Next, we're going to hear from one of my favorite. I love Fats Waller. He could play, but it's just something about his voice and his so tell us about what we're going to
hear. Absolutely. It was a style. Well, by 1915, everyone in Harlem knew that the best piano player was James P. Johnson. I mean, he played a new type of music that was eventually called stride piano. But they called it Black music, and not because it was a Black man playing this piano. It's because when you looked at the score, ragtime would have Black and white. Stride piano would have all Black, so the page looked Black. And James P. Johnson had lots of famous students like U.B. Blake and Lucky Roberts, Willie the Lion Smith, but it was Fats Waller that really grabbed his heart. So Fats Waller had a very special place, not only at the Cotton Club, but everywhere in America. And we're going to hear his most famous song, Ain't Misbehavin'.
No one to talk with, all by myself. No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the shelf. Ain't misbehavin', saving my love for you, for you, for you, for you. I know for certain the one I love. I'm through with flirting, it's you that I'm thinking of. Hey, misbehaving, saving my love for you. Like Jack Horner in the corner, don't go nowhere, what do I care? Believe me, I don't stay out late, no place to go. I'm home about eight, just me and my radio. Hey, misbehaving, saving all my love for you.
I love that I can't do it thing that he does. My favorite song of his is Your Feet's Too Big. And I know it wasn't, you know, it's not a song a lot of people know, but he's fun to listen to.
Absolutely.
And he's just so darn cool. Right? I mean, yeah. When you watch him perform, it's just like, he's just the charisma that he has. I love him. We are talking about the Cotton Club with Robert Wyatt. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Robert Wyatt, Steinway artist, Smithsonian Institution lecturer, and specialist in American music, also music director at Highfield Hall. We're talking about the Cotton Club. What do you have next?
Well, if you danced in the chorus line at the Cotton Club, you had to be under the age of 21. You had to be taller than 5'6" tall with really long legs, and your skin had to be as white as possible. But dancing at the Cotton Club is more than just the dance shows. It was people like Bill Bojangles Robinson used to come. Now, Bill Bojangles was he was the highest paid Black entertainer in this country for 50 years. So not only was he a sensational tap dancer, he was a very good actor. Hmm. And he had a very unusual first. He was the first African-American man to have a biracial song routine, dance routine in Hollywood. Wow. And it's with Shirley Temple.
Oh, right.
And the Little Colonel.
That's right.
And he does the step dance. So imagine a step dance. You have, you know, a V-shaped inverted with two stairways going up. Mm-hmm. At the top, you had a step where you could dance at the very top, and you could dance on the floor. So the clip you're going to hear is Bojangles Robinson doing his step dance with his feet and with his hands. Listen really carefully.
You can see it. You can't just visualize him doing this. It's
yes.
Amazing when you think about it, how
yes.
quick you have to be. And
yes.
Yeah. Wow.
Hours and hours, hundreds of hours of practicing to
yeah,
get that
Yeah, to get
precision.
That right. Yeah. You mentioned that in the chorus you had to be over 5'6" and long legs. It sounds like the Rockettes. Didn't they have to also be like between like what 5'8" and 5'10" or something
yes.
like that? And it's sort of the,
yes.
the similar requirements.
But they had to be white.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Wow. Right, so, and then that Bill Bojangles Robinson dancing with Shirley Temple is a classic. That's a classic clip,
yes.
right?
Yeah. And the same step dance,
yeah.
only not with the solo. They went actually up a staircase.
Yeah. All right, what's next?
Well, Cab Calloway, who was an unknown person in 1931, Duke Ellington was ready to leave. He'd made his name, and he was going out on his own. So they hired a new band director, the third in Cotton Club history, and it was Cab Calloway. And he just took the place to a new limit. In fact, a new height. In fact, he was the one who sort of moved the club from Harlem in 1936 downtown. And he had a song that he sang probably thousands of times in his life called Minnie the Moocher.
Folks, now here's a story about Minnie the Moocher. She was a red-hot hoochie-coocher. She was the roughest, toughest rail. But Minnie had a heart as big as a hay whale. Howdy, howdy, ho.
Howdy, howdy, ho.
Howdy, howdy, ho. Howdy,
howdy, ho.
She loved him though he was cocky. He took her down to Chinatown. He showed her how to kick the gong around.
Showed her how to kick the gong around.
Howdy ho!
Howdy ho!
Howdy ha!
Howdy ha!
What a weevil!
What a weevil!
You kind of want to do that, howdy, howdy. But you know what? As I'm listening to this, I'm also hearing Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi, Blues Brothers. They did a great rendition of this in, of course, the movie The Blues Brothers, and you know that very popular, I guess, album then we would call it.
Yeah.
Now we'd say CD.
Record.
Yeah, record. A record. Yes, that's right. Back when they made records. Well, that's a fun song.
Yeah, yeah.
Cab Calloway is fun.
Oh,
fun to watch.
Like. Fats Waller.
Yeah, right. That's right. See, you can see why the Cotton Club was so popular.
What a time, yeah. It was the number one place because everybody was sensational. The folks, the black folks, didn't really like working there because it was, you know, whites only patrons. But they also got paid really well because the club made lots of money.
And they got lots of exposure.
Exactly.
You know, with the Sunday night
exactly.
things that
lots
they did.
Of stars yeah. got their beginnings at the Cotton Club.
Yeah. All right. Who's next?
Well, there were two floor shows every night, lots of dancing. But floor shows, 11 o'clock in the evening, 2 o'clock in the morning.
My goodness.
And they were really reviews with all kinds of, it's like a song and dance routine. And since they changed the floor show every 6 weeks, they had to compose lots of music and have lots of choreographers come out and teach these young women how to dance the different shows. So they had Harold Arlen, who, you know, wrote Over the Rainbow, and had Dorothy Fields, you know, these incredible songwriters were doing lots and lots of work. And so Stormy Weather.
Great song.
Yes. Was sung at the Cotton Club for the first time in 1928 by Ethel Waters. And Ethel Waters was since 1990. So for 10 years, she'd been like the cream of the crop singers in Harlem. And she's going to sing Stormy Weather by Harold Arlen and Ted Koehler. And you'll love it.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky, stormy weather, since my man and I ain't together. Keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere, stormy weather. Just can't get my poor self together. I'm weary all the time, the time. So weary all the time. When he went away, the blues walked in and met me. If he stays away, old rocking chair will get me. All I do is pray the Lord above will let me walk in the sun once more. Can't go on. All I have in life is gone, stormy weather, since my man and I ain't together. Keeps raining all the time.
I love that song.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Now, didn't she have a TV show?
Yes. The Ethel Waters Show was sometime in the 1950s, and she was the first African-American woman to be nominated for an Emmy Award. Mm-hmm. So when I first heard Ethel Waters, it was because of her TV show, not because she sang at the Cotton Club in 1929. Right. No, but I'd never heard Stormy Waters until this year.
Yeah, and that Stormy Weather has been, I mean, a million artists have done that.
Well, Lena Horne sang it in the movie, Lena Horne got her start at the Cotton Club.
Yeah,
Ethel Waters.
I love Lena Horne. There's another voice. There's a magical voice there.
Cole Porter's favorite singer.
Yeah, I could see why. I could actually see why. All right, and then, of course, the great Billie Holiday. We can't forget about Billie Holiday.
Yes. Well, Billie Holiday was a latecomer to the Cotton Club. You know, she came to Harlem in 1929 when she was 15 years old and started singing professionally. By the time she was 18, she started playing with Benny Goodman. Then it was Teddy Wilson, Lester Young, and eventually Count Basie. So she sang everywhere because she had a different style, and people just, they went to a different place when they heard her sing. Mm-hmm. So we're going to hear Your Mother's Son-in-Law, and the clarinet player you're going to hear is Benny Goodman.
You know, I had heard she performed in Provincetown at one point.
Really?
Yeah. I don't remember where, but I remember when we were talking about jazz history on the Cape that she had performed in Provincetown.
Really?
Yeah. So she really had gone all over the place.
Yes.
Yeah, unfortunately, such a sad end to her life.
Well, she had a tough life. Tough childhood. And even when she came to New York, she was having all kinds of issues with her mother and, you know, sex and things. But she just had a different type of voice, and there's nothing like Billie Holiday. Yeah.
You know, there isn't a bad song that we're hearing.
No.
And I mean, this was a, you know, toe-tapping, you know, just fun, great music that the Cotton Club was known for. And you're actually going to be giving a talk about all of this.
Yes.
You're doing your lecture at Highfield Hall on May 3rd at 7 p.m., May 5th at 10 a.m. And I'm sure you're going to be including a lot more than what we're talking about here today.
And you're having visuals, you know.
I am. It's like when I saw that we were going to be doing talking about the Cotton Club, I was like, oh, there, that's going to be a lot of fun. It's always fun to see you, but that would be a lot of fun. So tell us a little bit about the final clip that we're going to hear.
Well, Louis Armstrong grew up in New Orleans, and once he picked up, you know, a horn, he knew his life. So he left New Orleans when he was a young man to go to Chicago to play second cornet in King Oliver's band. And King Oliver eventually left Chicago to go to New York because that was the place to be. That's where the money was. And Louis Armstrong played for a while with King Oliver, and then he started his own band. And there was the Hot Sevens in 1927. So Louis Armstrong, we could spend a whole hour talking mm-hmm. about just him. But this is a very early recording, Wild Man Blues. And if you listen carefully, you'll hear the young Louis Armstrong, who had a sound with the trumpet that no one has ever duplicated since.
All right, Robert Wyatt, Steinway Artist, Smithsonian Institution Lecturer, and Specialist in American Music, also Music Director at Highfield Hall. Thanks so much for coming and sharing all the fun sounds of the Cotton Club with us. And we'll go out with Louis Armstrong. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.